Dr. Ainstree is an expert in coolie diseases from Sumatra, which implies he may be of Dutch parentage. Horribly contagious contagions, Tanpanuli fever, and Black Formosa corruption. To date, no one save Dr. Ainstree knows what a corruption is, medically speaking. We are grateful for his sponsorship and wish him luck in wiping the floor with Sir Jasper Meek and Penrose Fisher.
Thirsty for more Sherlock Holmes mysteries? Want some audio CDs on the subject? Thrilling over the fact we need not confine ourselves to 60 stories? Ecstatic over new tales of the great detective and the good doctor? You need only visit wessexpress.com to discover wonderful pastiche titles, and please also support their outstanding scholarly works as they fill many a canonical nook and cranny.
The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with features written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you're a fan of The Great Detective, The Good Doctor, and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal, how to subscribe, or how to offer your own services at writing an article, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. Quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two-two-one mine?
So today on the Baker Street Babes, we have a very special guest. It's Adam Christopher. Adam is a novelist and comic writer, but most importantly for today's show, he is the author of the new Elementary tie-in novels, the first of which are available now in the United States and soon to be available in other places. The first novel is called The Ghost Line, and it starts with Sherlock and Watson investigating the death of a subway train driver who mysteriously has a very large hidden stash of money. Adam is more than just a Sherlock Holmes fan, though. He is also the winner of the Sir Julius Vogel Award, New Zealand's highest science fiction honor. His debut novel, Empire State, was Sci-Fi Now's Book of the Year and a Financial Times Book of the Year for 2012. Adam, welcome to the Baker Street Babes.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. So, would you be okay with being invested as an honorary Baker Street babe?
Oh, you know, that would be tremendous. tremendous and unexpected. But oh, yes, please.
We hope you're okay with it, because once you've answered these four questions, there's no going back.
Okay, I'm totally committed.
Okay, so what initially got you into the world, any world, any incarnation? What was your first Sherlock Holmes? How did you get into it?
I think I was probably about 7 or 8 years old, and somehow I got one of those really nice kind of facsimile Strand magazine editions of all the collected Sherlock Holmes stories, with all the illustrations and everything. And I think that's my first memory of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, my parents are both big readers. I'm sure that book was probably from their collection. So basically, for as long as I can remember kind of reading, I've been reading Sherlock Holmes.
That's awesome. All answers are awesome, but we always enjoy the slightly nerdy ones as well. As far as adaptations of Sherlock Holmes, which of the adaptations, and you could say Elementary easily, but you needn't. What is your favorite of all the adaptations that you've seen?
I'm probably going to pick the obvious one. Maybe my favorite adaptation has to be the Jeremy Brett Granada TV series. That ran for 10 years, and as a kind of accurate, not entirely accurate, but mostly accurate historical, adaptation of the original stories, I think that really hasn't been beaten yet. But, I've got quite a... I don't know if I should be ashamed to admit it or not, but I've got quite a soft spot for the first Robert Downey Jr. movie. I love the first one. The second one we can talk about later, but
they're so good.
Yeah, I love the idea of. I mean, it's also what Elementary does as well, but I love, and Sherlock from BBC, but the idea of taking something and like just changing it and kind of being quite happy to consider it a, like an alternate universe version of the original material. You know, but Jeremy Brett, I have to say.
Yeah, outstanding. And you're gonna reach a lot of people on the podcast who love Robert Downey Jr. And,
oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, outstanding. And Jeremy Brett as well, because, of course, he was classic. So who is your favorite character from the canon?
I think it has to be Holmes, because right from the very beginning, he's this outsider. You know, he almost exists outside of the normal human experience, which is why the narrator for I think 99% of the stories is Watson, because he's our kind of identifier. I'm a big fan of Doctor Who, and to me, the kind of the Holmes Watson thing is like a Doctor and Companion, but exactly for the same reasons, because the Doctor is this kind of alien outsider, and we can't understand how he thinks and works, which I think is the same for Holmes.
Yeah,
it's a really obvious answer, but
it's not at all. And I actually think that the Doctor Who comparison is really lovely, because there's the character that is sort of unattainable, and then there's the character with whom, you know, you can personally identify, almost
right,
like a Greek
yeah.
chorus, you know, something.
Yeah,
along.
Exactly.
So for the fourth and final question, after which you will inevitably be a Baker Street Babe, whether you like it or not, an honorary Baker Street Babe. Out of everyone in the canon, with whom would you most like to have tea with? With whom would you most like to have tea and discuss the goings on at Baker Street or anywhere else? Any character. Who'd you like to have a chat with?
Oh, Mrs. Hudson.
Why Mrs. Hudson?
Well, because if you're talking about having tea with somebody and trying to find out what's actually going on at Baker Street, you know, she knows way more than we think. You know, she's just the housekeeper, stays out of the way, makes the tea and collects Holmes's post. There's something else going on. She's a mastermind of her own.
Is there a specific iteration of her that you really like? You know, whether it's... Yeah, I think actually the elementary version is like the most underutilized version of Mrs. Hudson ever in the history of adaptations.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, the elementary version is really brilliant, but she's in, what, 4 episodes or something?
Yeah.
That's criminal. She needs carriage.
It's bizarre, but I suppose, I don't know, she's a recurring character.
She is a recurring character who, like, mysteriously is really good at police scanners, apparently.
Yeah.
She's just got to be in more episodes.
I think the elementary one is definitely, she's got, you know, secrets and skills that we don't know about.
Skills with a Z.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Adam Christopher. You are now an honorary Baker Street Babe.
Welcome to the club.
Oh, hooray. Thank you very much. I shall put that on my website.
We can't
Please
wait.
Do.
Little tagline. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the elementary tie-in novels. You actually reaching out to us was the first that we had heard of it. So
oh, really?
We were obviously really excited, but also clearly in the dark. So tell us kind of how that came to be.
It's one of those kind of weird things where it all just comes together by random chance. The tie-ins are published by Titan, and they do a lot of TV tie-in stuff. They do like Supernatural and Grimm, Fringe, various bits and pieces. They actually, in the UK, they publish my science fiction novels. So I think it was, I went down and had lunch with the editors, probably just after I'd signed with them a couple of years ago. And one of those things happened, we're just like talking about TV shows, and because I'm obviously, apart from being an elementary fan, I've watched lots of TV. I'm a TV fan. And it just came up, oh yeah, they're doing elementary. Okay, great. And just kind of the conversation went on, because they do lots of tie-in stuff. And I was kind of sitting there for the rest of the hour just thinking, how do I write this book? How do I get involved? Because this is what, you know, one of my dream jobs to get.
Is it your dream job because you always wanted to do something with Sherlock Holmes as a writer, or what component of it was so fascinating to you?
It's kind of three things. So there's Sherlock Holmes, there's the fact that I'm a fan of elementary, the series anyway, and the fact that it's a tie-in novel. Now, I know tie-in novels are kind of viewed differently to, you know, what you call original fiction, which is my other stuff. But kind of growing up with Doctor Who and a kind of classic British television, the tie-in novel was, for some reason, was always a kind of goal.
You're talking to somebody who used to read a lot of Star Trek tie-in novels.
Exactly. So. Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who. Yeah. You know, I've got a shelf full of, you know, upstairs, downstairs, and wow. Star Maidens, and really kind of obscure stuff. Because I love it. I'm a fan of all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, this kind of came up, and then, you know, I got home and I was like, I emailed my agent and said, you've got to get me one of these books because it would be like a dream. And then they kind of, one of those things where nothing really happened because they were already doing this, they'd already got a schedule and a timeline and they got people involved and it was already underway. So I was like, oh, well, you know, one of those things that on, you know, it's the opportunity was not there. So that's fine. You know, that's what happens. And kind of life went on for probably, I don't know, 6 or 9 months. And then I got an email from my agent and it's like, do you still want to do an elementary novel? And I was like, yeah, okay, fine. Of course. Because every night when I've been watching elementary, I'd kind of shake my fist at the opening titles going, if only.
You were cuddling the DVD against your chest. As you
I was. And yeah, weeping quietly into my tea.
Well, so that's interesting to me, though, because a lot of people... I think elementary is actually really underappreciated, and it's
here.
Part of the reason why I think it's really underappreciated is because Sherlock Holmes is so prevalent in our culture right now, which is fantastic. Right. And we're really excited about, yeah. But it's sort of one of the later things to come onto the scene. And it doesn't necessarily have the giant big names or the crazy excited girls on Tumblr, like some of the other adaptations do.
Yeah,
and right. So what do you love about elementary? What did you find so appealing about it?
Well, it's an interesting question because I actually think the reason why elementary works for me so well is because it's not really Sherlock Holmes. You know, it's much further distanced from the canon than, you know, the BBC's Sherlock, which is the obvious comparison because they're both modern day, you know, interpretations of the characters.
Sure.
In elementary, you've got Holmes, you've got Watson, and you've got this basically like a slightly weird police procedural where they kind of borrow bits and pieces from the canon. You know, there's characters or there's plot lines here and there, and they're kind of twisted and adapted. But the whole show just dips in and out. It doesn't. It's not really based on anything from the original canon. Sometimes more than others, obviously. And I think that actually works. And it's one of the reasons why I think you say, you know, elementary doesn't have that kind of awareness amongst, you know, that kind of fandom is because it's more mainstream, basically. You know, this is a primetime network TV show, of which there are loads.
Yeah, there are. And interesting, I think you're spot on in saying that because I was fortunate enough to speak at UCLA a couple of years ago about Sherlock Holmes film and TV adaptations, and Rob Doherty was doing a Q&A right before the first episode of Elementary came out. And somebody the audience asked him, for whom are these episodes really designed? And he said, well, CBS viewers. I could not have found a more pure, practical, wonderful answer to that question, because I think that the writers more and more have started nerding out about all these, you know, canonical elements. But essentially, if you're going to do what is structurally a police procedural, like Doherty is doing and like, you know, the rest of the showrunners are doing, then you have to appeal to your audience or you're going to get canned in like 2 seconds. So I think that it actually brings Holmes to a much wider audience, and the casting has been outstanding. And so I think that your analysis of that is frankly spot on.
It's one of those things where, you know, when they borrow from the canon, it's great for fans like us because we spot everything and we know how they've done it. And yeah, the Kitty Winter storyline from season 3, which is just finished, it's fantastic and clever and we can appreciate that. But if you don't know any of that and you haven't read the stories, it doesn't matter because you've still got a really solid detective show. It's a very difficult thing, and, you know, all credit to the showrunners and the writers, for sure.
Well, and I think what's so brilliant about that, because now that you've brought up Kitty Winter, you know, I really feel like what's brilliant about it is that they dig so deep into canon that it's almost such an obscure detail. I mean, Kitty Winter is mentioned in one story. Mm. She's not even a main character in the story. But they have actually taken the ethos of what Doyle wrote and created a life around this person that you can actually see making sense in the canon. And that's sort of the beauty of it when you really do love Sherlock Holmes. And it's actually still a beautiful story, even if you don't love Sherlock Holmes. And so I'm interested to hear how much of that has inspired your writing as you've gone to start to write these novels.
I think it has. The novel is kind of, I mean, obviously it's written to be like a TV story, but longer, because obviously a novel is much more, it's longer, basically. So it's like, I kind of wrote it like this is kind of the feature length, double episode, two part story kind of thing. I borrowed from bits and pieces from the Holmes canon. But I was also aware that it has to be an original story in its own right. And the difficult thing in my mind is thinking, actually, it should be able to be read by people who don't watch Elementary, which kind of sounds weird, because why would they? But yeah, it has to be a crime mystery that you can pick up. And okay, if you watch Elementary, you know the characters, then you'll probably get more out of it. But everything should be there. And again, it's like,
which is the same ethos as Elementary has to follow.
Right. It's just kind of, it's for a CBS audience, and that's in no way denigrating the show or the book or anything. It's like, no, it has to be.
Oh, it's complimenting.
Yeah. Well, it has to be entertaining. It has to make sense, logical. You know, it's a book that you can pick up and read. So yeah, I mean, I think this particular story, the Ghost Line. I mean, I've got quite an interest in New York City history. And this was kind of my opportunity to really indulge myself in some obscure bits of research about the city. So in this particular book, there's more of that than borrowing or sort of referring back to the actual Holmes canon.
May I just ask you a quick question here? Because I only had the privilege of reading the preview that was published on Criminal Element.
Oh,
but,
cool. Yes.
Which was outstanding, but I live here, and I lived in Manhattan for 10 years, and now I live in Queens,
right.
And you nailed New York City.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
No, it was great. I mean, the minute we walked into Hell's Kitchen, I was like, yep, like artisanal marmalade.
Yeah.
I don't need it. You know, like it was really great. And I am curious, whether part of what draws you to Elementary is New York City, or maybe part of what drew you to writing this book, or how did you go about doing, have you been here before? Because I just thought that New York as a setting for you really worked brilliantly.
Oh, thank you. Well, actually, yeah, I mean, my first novel, which came out in 2012, I think, it's called Empire State, and it's a science fiction novel, but it's set in like an alternate universe version of New York City, where it's just Manhattan Island, and it's surrounded by this kind of fog barrier. And it's kind of like a 30s prohibition, 20s prohibition type thing. But anyway, so like I've always had this interest.
Sorry, if you hear clicking, I'm just quietly ordering that.
Excellent.
That sounds awesome.
But yeah, I mean, so I've always had this kind of interest in New York City. I don't quite know how, why. I think it may have something to do with comics, because I'm a big fan of comics, especially like Golden Age comics, which is, you know, late 30s, 40s. And of course, New York City was where that all began. Yeah, American superhero comics, I'm talking about. So that period is always kind of...
You mean like the war propaganda ones, or...?
No, Superman, Batman, comics, detective comics.
Yeah, action comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I've been to New York several times. One of my publishers is in New York, my agent's in New York, and I just absolutely love it, and I love the history of the place. I think it's so enthralling for me. And certainly when Elementary arrived, that was obviously part of the appeal, was the fact that it was set in modern day New York, and it's filmed there as well. It's not one of these shows where they kind of film it in Vancouver or something.
We come across it all.
Right. That would be amazing. But yeah, but New York City is as much a character in the book and in the show as the rest of them. And I think I really have to get it right for the book. Because I don't, you're right, I don't live there. I've visited it, I love it, but I don't live there. So, you know, research was really important. But I'm glad it worked. I'm so glad to hear that. It's brilliant. Thank you.
I'm really interested. In the excerpt that I read, I actually thought that your treatment of Joan was pretty good as well. And I think it is one of the big challenges or one of the big differentiators that people see with the elementary adaptation is this introduction of Joan Watson versus John. And I'm curious how you approached her and how you thought about her as you were sitting down to sort of flesh out her character in the written word.
Well, I knew from the beginning that she had to be the point of view character because Watson is the point of view character. And that's what I was saying before. You know, we can't comprehend how Holmes operates because he's beyond our experience. So I knew that Watson had to be the point of view character, and I knew that I was writing Joan Watson. So, yeah, I think the book really begins. I think that excerpt, trying to think back, there's like an intro, which is a kind of your pre-credit sequence.
Yep.
Yeah. And then it kicks in with Watson being woken up by Holmes in a classic manner.
Exactly. It's like, yes, that's the show.
No, thanks. Yeah, as I was writing it, I really studied the episodes. You know, I would watch an episode like first thing in the morning before I started writing just to get back into the world. And we're talking about rewatching. I mean, I've seen each episode probably 5 or 6 times. And I really kind of broke down the relationship between the Johnny Lee Miller's version of Holmes and Lucy Liu's version of Watson and how they're actually so perfectly balanced. Because she initially you think is maybe a bit cold, a bit kind of distant, whereas he's kind of chaotic and slightly dangerous. But really, they're balanced perfectly. And, you know, he teaches her about his work and his vocation, and she teaches him about people and how people work. So, which is why together, I mean, it's the same with any kind of Holmes adaptation, but that's why together they're the perfect, pair of investigators. But yeah, it was kind of that balance became really clear because I was analyzing it really, really, probably overanalyzing it, just trying to get into the characters. Because that's the other thing was being a tie-in, you know, these characters are not mine. They are portrayed by these amazing actors on TV, and they were created by the showrunners. So really, I had to get it right, because when people pick up the book, as I would pick up the book as a fan of TV shows, I want those characters that I love and that I know, and that I think I know better than anybody because I watch a TV show, as everybody does. You know, you have to get that right because... You know, and you probably read tie-ins or novelizations where you kind of wonder, and it's unfortunate. It's like, you know, have you seen the show? Have you actually played the game? But they happen sometimes, but I really didn't want to make that mistake.
It happens a lot in video games, actually, I think. Like, right. You know, a lot of the Sherlock Holmes video games, it'll be like, oh, your home base is 221B, and that's about it. Like, there's this sort of, like, line that's drawn in the sand, and then it never goes anywhere from there. Yeah.
But you mentioned playing the game. I mean, phrasing it like that as, as the people who, you know, write countless essays and play with the canonical Sherlock Holmes and, you know, try to figure out Watson's dates and, you know, like, what's the deal with the missing bullpup and why didn't you ever write about the giant rat of Sumatra and what's going on here with your two first names, John James Watson. Playing the game, do you feel like you're playing the game with elementary, with the canon, but with the elementary canon?
Yeah, a little bit. It's actually interesting now I think about it, because I was definitely caught up in the continuity of the show, because to chart the path of people and objects and shoe sizes and things through the show, not so much with the actual canon, because I kind of borrowed bits and pieces, but there was, you know.
But you're working off the elementary canon.
Oh,
so I just wonder
if
you feel like you're, in a sense, playing the game with that canon instead of playing the game with the ACD canon.
Yeah, no, actually, yeah, I think I am. And that's really interesting. Now that I think about it, I am. Yeah. I had to track down the make of Watson's car and the colour and Detective Bell's shoe size.
Of course.
But that's all in there. It's all in there. It's
For all the listeners out there, when I say playing the game, I mean it in all capitals. And the practice of taking a particular canon and riffing off of it in a way that's as accurate as you possibly can make it.
Right.
Are there any other times that stood out for you where you had to, you know, find something that you, oh God, I don't know exactly, you know, what t-shirt Joan was wearing in episode whatever, like, where you had to be very specific?
Definitely, there was a game being played. I guess I'm actually kind of lucky because right from the beginning, the showrunners have kept track of everything. So I had a very secret show Bible, huge and unwieldy, and you couldn't possibly read it. And I guess finding the relevant information within that was a challenge in itself. But yeah, absolutely. Trying to work within the continuity and the chronology of Elementary, you know, which has had 80-something episodes now, maybe not quite so much.
Y'all got a big canon.
Yeah.
Already.
And things like you know, Detective Bell's shoe size, which kept me awake for hours and hours.
What is it? Just so we know.
It's a... See, I'm gonna get it wrong now, aren't I?
Oh, no.
It's like 10.5. No, it's not 10.5. It plays...
Are you talking about Detective Bell's shoe size or John Michael Hill's shoe size?
Detective Bell's shoe size, as stated on TV.
Oh, as stated on TV.
Yes. Oh, yes. And, you know, Watson's car, which you see in one episode, but she has a car. And, you know, the make and colour. And, you know, things like that kind of drive you crazy. But I didn't really want to get bogged down in that because you could, you know, overdo it a little bit. So for my own sanity, I kind of crossed my fingers.
you could found an entire quarterly journal based on ephemera from the elementary.
I need to start hiding things in the books. Mm. And then people could have a quarterly journal about the books.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, that's an idea.
Uh-huh. That's super meta, dude. I like
Is there a, you know, one of the things that I think is really a huge strength of the casting in that show is just the chemistry between Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu. It's just sort of an undeniable amount of understanding that I think they have together as actors. And yes. I'm curious sort of what strengths you drew upon in terms of their interactions or particular neuroses that they've brought to their characters that you've been able to translate or that you were excited to translate.
That is a very intense question, but a really good one and a very difficult one. Their relationship on TV really develops over the episodes to the extent where I'd say if you were to watch the latest episode and then go back to the pilot, well, not the pilot, maybe episode 2 or 3, it is completely different, as you'd expect it to be. There's a lot of business between them, even in episodes where nothing much is happening or scenes where nothing is happening. When they're in a room together, there's a certain way they behave towards each other, which they don't behave when they're at the police precinct or out at a crime scene. And I think those moments, they're hard to define. They're kind of the stuff that happens in between the lines of dialogue. But that's what part of what makes their chemistry so amazing. And you see it in other shows where we have characters and leads who work so well together. So, yeah, I mean, capturing that obviously is so difficult.
I think thing that is like always really sort of, and I think it's perhaps maybe one of my strange obsessions with how this show has sort of picked and chosen different modern things, but to me it's sort of in their interactions around the turtle Clyde. Like there's such it's like their child, but not really, you know. It's sort of like this bizarre relationship that they have around how the Clyde should be treated. And so the perfect example is is Sherlock letting Clyde paint with a paintbrush Joan being totally incensed about it without even saying anything. And it's such a perfect kind of dynamic that is really hard to, you're right, it's hard to describe, but it's, to me, it's a very specific one because it's so different, I think, from what we've seen in other adaptations where it's sort of like, oh, they're very jovial and brotherly and, you know, they understand each other. There's a level of seriousness to it that I think is really different and worth paying attention to.
And you see it also when Kitty appears, the way that Holmes and Watson interact with her and then with each other, especially when Kitty gets into trouble. You see this whole side of their relationship, which is like the Clyde thing, actually, but kind of on a different level. which is amazing.
I would love for you to tell people a little bit about how many tie-in novels there's going to be, what you're working on next, some of the basics of what the future is for this.
So The Ghost Line is the first book. There's going to be more books, and they're going to come out at some point. But,
so keep your eyes open.
Yeah, it's like one of those things, because the timelines kind of, they move around, and yeah, everybody's schedule kind of shifts around. So there's definitely more coming, and they're definitely going to be coming out soon, but there's nothing kind of concrete that I can say at the moment. But yeah, I mean, the second book is on the horizon. I think I'm allowed to say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious with, you clearly are passionate about the characters of Sherlock Holmes and Joan or John Watson and about Elementary as an adaptation and, you know, about essentially jazz riffing off of them, which is, I think, completely awesome. And I'm curious, where do you see Sherlock Holmes adaptations going in the future? I mean, we're in kind of a new renaissance right now. We had one in the 70s, right? Where, right. You know, you had Murder by Decree, Study and Terror, 7% Solution, all of these wonderful things, and people got into Sherlock Holmes again. Now, Sherlock Holmes never really went away. Mm. But do you see any sort of, like, what would you like to see out of a completely new adaptation of Sherlock Holmes that you haven't seen yet?
I'm not sure, really. I think probably on TV. I wonder if there'd be a trend to go back to more historically accurate or literarily, whatever that word is, accurate. Sure. Adaptations, because, you know, there's obviously the Sherlock and Elementary and the Robert Downey Jr. movies.
I would argue that House is part of that model.
Yeah.
House and D.
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
I've heard it described that way, actually.
All of them quite modern.
Yeah. So I think it'll probably go in a kind of curve back the other way. But I think there's more home stuff going on now than ever. I mean, you know, Titan, who published these Elementary tie-in novels, they also publish original Sherlock Holmes novels.
Oh, yes, they do.
Yeah, exactly. They do.
Including ones by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, yes.
They do? How did I miss on Kareem's novel? I missed that one entirely.
Was he doing, he's doing Mycroft, I think.
Mr. Abdul-Jabbar is doing a novel with a co-writer. I believe her name is Anna Winterhouse, and it's called Mycroft Holmes. So it's about Mycroft. That is essentially a canonical spinoff in and of itself. But Titan, yeah, your publisher is doing great things for furthering the Holmes cause all over the place.
And they also do not just Titan, but other publishers as well. You know, there's Professor Moriarty novels. There's Sherlock Holmes going into kind of Lovecraftian horror and science fiction.
Sure.
Solaris, which another publisher, had an anthology of science fictional Sherlock Holmes stories set in the future. So the wonderful thing about it is that you can do anything, really, and you can really stretch the boundaries of it, because you only need a few things. It's almost like Elementary. You only need a few things to make it Sherlock.
What do you think are the essential things, like in your Bible for writing? What do you think are the essential things that for you to read it, you think, oh, I see, it's Sherlock Holmes?
Well, it has to be Holmes and Watson. And I think that's probably just about it. And the fact that these archetypal characters, Holmes the outsider, the genius that we can't understand, Watson the identifier who's one of us, who through them we perceive, we get this kind of window into Holmes' world. That's probably it. I said before, it's quite like Doctor Who in a way. Possibly Doctor Who actually is influenced quite a lot by Sherlock Holmes. Deliberately so.
Well, no doubt in this era, especially with Moffat.
Well, yes. But yeah, I grew up watching, coming from New Zealand, John Pertwee, the Third Doctor, because TV in New Zealand was like 10 years out of date. So when I was growing up in the 80s watching this, you know, you got the Doctor and you got the Master, who is Moriarty. And deliberately, they said we need to have a Moriarty for the Doctor, so they created the Master. But yeah, I think, you know, Holmes is never going to go away, because it works. It's just that simple concept of the two characters, and you can do anything with it.
I have one specific elementary question I want to ask. It has to do with the fact that I can't actually think of any adaptation, whether it's on screen or in books or comics even, where the use of drugs is actually treated as a recovery storyline, as right. Sherlock needing to recover and going through this process of not, and I think one of the things that they've really done their due diligence on Elementary is not pretending that it was a temporary fix, that actually this is a lifelong struggle for Sherlock, and they continue to bring it back in really meaningful ways.
Yes.
So I'm curious what your plans are with that, if you plan to introduce that at all in your tie-in novels, or how you feel about it.
I think the way they handle it in the show is really good. You know, the fact that he's a recovering addict is actually the kind of MacGuffin that gets him to New York in the first place. So that kind of creates the show, because he's escaped from London, basically. In the first book, there is a little bit of it, but it's not overt. It's more the fact that he is an addict and always will be an addict. And for those people, every day is a challenge and a struggle. And there's ways you can... the ways you're going to become that. And that's what he does kind of all the time. And obviously, over time, you see it on the TV show, you know, he gets further and further away from that kind of life, his past life. But it's always kind of there. And they kind of bring it back now and again, just to remind everybody that that's actually part of who he is. So
you mean like with the Lestrade episodes, that kind of thing, where he goes back?
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, yeah. People like Alfredo turn up. Occasionally.
Sure.
I love Alfredo. I wish he was around more.
Well, he's actually one of my favorite characters. He's in the Ghost Line.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that was like, I've got to put Alfredo in. He must be in the book. And he is.
Good.
Definitely when we were doing the book, we worked with CBS and the showrunners to kind of make sure everything, because it has to fit into the TV series, basically.
Explain that to people. So how does that work? I mean, do you sort of say to them, this is the kind of mystery that I want to write, or this is the kind of story I want to write, or what? How did that develop?
Right. So basically, I had to come up with a story. So basically, yeah, it's absolutely my novel, my story. Having, you know, the fact that I understand Elementary and how it works means I could actually write an Elementary story. So I had to write one that was kind of bigger, because a book is longer than a TV episode. And yeah, well, it was like a series of outlines, chapter breakdowns, you know, that CBS and the showrunners kind of approved and checked, just to make sure that I wasn't, you know, I could do anything I wanted to do, so long as I wasn't really breaking the boundaries of the show. Like, I couldn't kill somebody. You kind of had to return everything back to the status quo at the end, because even though it kind of fits into the TV show, not everyone's going to read the book who watches TV. And there could well be people that read the book but don't see the show. So there kind of has to be a little bit of separation. And there's not really a point where you can say it fits between episode, you know, season 2, episode 3 and 4. It kind of floats. It's probably season 2. What is season 2? Probably second half of season 2. But it's kind of nebulous. Doesn't really matter.
So you could more gauge it by the relationships between the characters,
yes,
when it happens, rather than direct chronological.
Yes. Some things are specifically mentioned in the book that happen on TV, so you can definitely say it takes place after some events. But yeah, it's kind of, especially because the writing process and the TV show operate on such different timelines, there's no way you can get them to line up. You know, that would be impossible. But certain things I couldn't do, because they were either going to do it on TV, or there was characters that I wanted to borrow actually from the canon that they said, well, maybe you could use someone else, because if we want to do something in the future with that character, you may have done something to them, which they then have to try and undo. Because you do.
Oh my, you're so not allowed to tell us who those people are that they said, meh, you can't use them, but man, do we want to know.
Yeah, I'm sworn to secrecy.
That's interesting, though. So they essentially, yeah, said, well, that person, we might want to, you know, muck with their lives.
Yeah, and I think that they're probably just, a lot of the stuff is just them thinking ahead in terms of, well, maybe we've got all this volume of work that we can borrow from, so yeah, we may use that character. So please don't kill that person, you know, don't reinvent the character in this way, because we just might want to use it later. So that's, yeah, fair enough. But I really had complete free rein. I could do whatever I liked, provided it was an elementary story.
That's a very cool process.
It was, it was fun. It was like the most fun I've had writing. You know.
What makes a good mystery for you, a Sherlock Holmes mystery or a good crime for Sherlock to solve?
It has to have something that only Holmes could possibly solve. It's like throughout the writing process and also for the second book, it's like, is there enough Sherlock in this? You know, it can't just be a mystery, like a police procedural where there's a crime and a victim and they kind of, there's clues and they solve it. He has to do something beyond the capabilities of normal people. So in the ghost line, he's kind of learning another language and tasting crime scenes and things like that, because this is what he'd do. Of course he'd learn another language that he's never heard of to solve a crime.
Of course he would. Taste a crime.
Yeah. But that is the defining thing. It's like, what makes a Sherlock Holmes story a Sherlock Holmes story? What makes an elementary story an elementary story? It's like, there's something in it. He's not just a detective. He's Sherlock Holmes.
I was a little bit curious whether, since you also write comics, what sort they were, and if you ever, you know, like, could conceive yourself of writing some sort of either Sherlock Holmes or elementary comic adaptation.
Yeah, that would be great.
Right?
That would be, yeah, awesome. I'm writing a comic called The Shield. I'm co-writing it with a friend of mine called Chuck Wendig. It's a superhero comic for Dark Circle.
Yes.
Yeah, which is Archie Comics, a superhero imprint, which is kind of coming back to life. And The Shield is kind of a patriotic superhero. Actually, he predates Captain America by 18 months.
Wow.
And Captain America became popular and everyone thinks of him, so but we've reinvented the Shield as a female superhero. It's a modern day adaptation, it's a brand new thing, and it's super exciting because I love comics, I love superheroes. So
you're working with Chuck Wendig on a female Shield? I think part of me exploded.
It's fun, it's so good. It's I'm so thrilled to be working with Archie Comics. It's like, what? Archie Comics? Yeah. Come on.
They're an institution, kind of.
Yeah. And, you know, this new, you know, these superheroes have always existed. They've got a bigger superhero library as Marvel and DC, but it just kind of comes and goes. But this is it's a new start. It's awesome. But
to what extent do you think Sherlock Holmes is a superhero in any
way? Yeah, people kind of...
Do you think of him like that, or...?
I guess, you know, people do describe him in that way. It's kind of difficult. Like, Batman is a superhero, but he's not superpowered. And he is also the world's greatest detective. You know, Batman is a crime. But Batman is Sherlock Holmes, but he just dresses up, like, as a bat. Because, of course he does. And there's a bit more kind of punching bad guys. So I kind of, I don't know, I don't really see Sherlock Holmes as a superhero. I think he's beyond us normal people. I don't know. Does that make him a superhero? I'm not sure.
I was just curious where you drew that line, because, you know, he's a genius, he's a boxer, he's a ninja, he's, you know.
Yeah, he's all the things.
He's generally trying to do good things. Not always, but generally. Trying to solve murders and, you know, find the bad guy a lot of the time.
Maybe he is a superhero because he has an ability which nobody else has in real life. You know, Batman has his gadgets because he's Bruce Wayne, and these gadgets are actually impossible. So Sherlock Holmes has his mind and his skills, which actually, because it's fiction, right, he can solve anything. So that's beyond real life. So maybe he is a superhero.
We'll leave the question open for debate.
I think that's a good one to leave open. Because it just means that we'll have more adaptations. Maybe one day. I mean, Sherlock did have a cape at one point, let's be honest. So there is definitely a lot of capes going on, especially in the 1970s.
Oh, my God. The train fight.
Yes.
Dude, the sword fight on the top of the train in 7% Solution.
Yes.
Like, let's talk about that for a second. That's a superhero move.
Well, Adam, it's been so fun to have you on the show. Tell people about where they can get your elementary tie-in novels.
Right. Well, if you go to my website, which is adamchristopher.ac, There's a books link you can click on, and it's got order links for all your favorite places like Amazon and Barnes & Noble and IndieBound and Pals, and you can find it anywhere, basically. It's out now, so yeah.
And can people follow you on Twitter?
They can. I'm on Twitter as Ghostfinder.
Ghostfinder, that's epic.
Ghostfinder. And I'm on Facebook as Adam Christopher.
Awesome.
Adam, thank you so much. This was outstanding. We deeply appreciate it and look forward to checking back in with you when you've made more of these.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?